Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Scott Pranger. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. And welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking to CEO Scott Pranger. Chief Executive Officer Scott Pranger is a three-time Inc. 500 entrepreneur and holds a demonstrated track record in expanding publicly traded and early-stage companies into U.S. and international markets. Pranger occupied multiple executive positions and served on boards of directors, garnering significant experience in profit and loss management, mergers and acquisitions, and venture capital and private equity fundraising. An established force in the fields of entrepreneurial information technology and software industry operations, Southern Illinois University, 1986, Wharton School, 1996, and Vanderbilt University, 1997. Pranger was inducted into his university's College of Business and Analytics Hall of Fame in 2004, CEO of Nashville's Stax. Stax is a leading provider of transformative digital assets and mobile payment solutions to the sports industry. Their mission is to provide participants with the ability to create new and profitable digital economies while increasing fan engagement. Stax enables its customers to remove friction, build trust, and unlock new value within their fan base. Led by a talented team of information technology and software industry veterans, Stax brings combined experience in fintech, cybersecurity, mobile apps, and AWS-based enterprise-grade software architecture and strategy. Joining us today to talk about cryptocurrency and the cyber world of finance. Mr. Pranger, hello, how are you?
Very good, Steve. Thank you for inviting me to your show.
Great to have you. I'm so glad you are. Am I saying that right? Is it Pranger?
It's, you know, my family actually pronounces it Pranger, which is more of a German pronunciation, but whatever's easiest for the audience or really anyone I'm dealing with. So most people, you know, use the Americanized version, which is Pranger, which is okay with me.
Okay. Well, with a name like Abramowitz, I go by Steve every chance I get as well. So
yeah.
So thanks for coming on here to teach us about cryptocurrency. I think this will be great information. So to begin, what is the difference between Bitcoin, Dogecoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, Ripple, EOS, and all the rest?
Well, I mean, the big difference is that in the case of Ether and Bitcoin, they're considered to be decentralized protocols that once the rules were established in terms of, how many original Bitcoins there would be, when and how those could get minted, when there would be an actual split in the number given the total market cap and number of users. Those particular cryptocurrencies, if you want to call them that, are completely unmanaged by human beings and are totally driven by the market once the technology platforms were established for supporting both. But in the case of the other cryptocurrencies, those are centrally managed and controlled cryptocurrencies that are actually created by humans and managed by humans, so the humans control, you know, how many, how they get split. There's an opportunity to actually help influence the price of those cryptocurrencies because of the way they're created and the fact that humans are involved in the management in terms of the volume and whatnot. So one is basically decentralized, no central control. And in the case of many of the others you mentioned, they're actually centrally managed by and controlled really by companies.
And how does that differ than, say, cash from the Federal Reserve?
Well, the you know, the Federal Reserve is actually closer to a centrally managed and human controlled currency than let's say a Bitcoin, because the Federal Reserve actually has control over the amount of currency that's in circulation. There's control over, you know, by the central bank on the interest rate that the, you know, central bank charges, you know, banks and financial institutions to borrow from the U.S. government. So actually, Bitcoin is kind of the exact opposite to the Federal Reserve today.
So this all started a long time ago, money that is. Aristotle defined the characteristics of good money more than 2,000 years ago. According to him, money must be four things: durable, it must not be easily destroyed; portable, it must be easy to carry around; divisible, such that the parts yielded by the division would be interchangeable. A dollar becomes a quarter, becomes a nickel. Relatively rare and intrinsically valuable. So most of us believe that the money or currency, euros, dollars, pounds, et cetera, we use daily is good money. But is that really the case? And is crypto any of that?
Well, I think most people, when they look at Bitcoin or Ether, for example, it's considered to be a currency, and its value is only its value is totally dependent on the trust that the people have that control, you know, that have Bitcoin in their possession, believe that it's worth. But I actually believe that in the case of Ether and Bitcoin, they actually provide another service, really, to economies, and that it's almost like a form of an insurance product, and that people from multiple countries that are users of locally printed and managed fiat currencies, it's a way for those individuals to almost exchange their fiat currencies for almost like an insurance product. So it's a hedge against inflation and devaluation, which is caused by a central bank authority increasing the volume of currency that's in circulation. So, most people that have Bitcoin today are not using it really as a currency. It's really being used today as a hedge against inflation and devaluation of the local fiat currencies in the countries that these people are in, due to basically the monetary policy of the countries that they're part of, and the continual printing of money.
Right, making that rare part go away.
Yeah, but I do believe there's another huge trend that's been underway, Steve, for years, and that is that fiat currencies have slowly over time started to disappear, and probably and for a lot of the reasons that we mentioned, inflation, devaluation of the currency through the local country's monetary supply, and so really, the euro, to some degree, is a result of that, and the euro ended up replacing, the franc in France, and the Deutsche Mark in Germany and other European countries. And but that whole trend of currencies kind of slowly but surely disappearing has been going on for a while now, and. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. Go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say that the global M1 supply, which includes all the money in circulation plus traveler's checks and demand deposits like checking and savings account, was $48.9 trillion as of November 28th, 2022, according to Visual Capitalist. They estimate the total value of the M2 supply to be $82.6 trillion. Where does crypto market fit in there?
Well, I think, you know, you've seen countries like El Salvador, for example, embrace, you know, cryptocurrency. And really, I think that's almost like the Germans having embraced the euro to some degree. So, you know, they haven't totally displaced their country's local currency yet. But I do believe that probably will occur over time. And that you'll, especially in emerging markets like France and South America, where you have countries that have been kind of ravaged by inflation and, you know, having currencies that don't incur the same like global trust that the U.S. dollar does or even the Chinese yuan does today. I think, you know, there's a future, and it probably isn't that far out, maybe 50 years, I don't know what the number is, but where you could see the entire continent of Africa almost being based solely on Bitcoin, same with South America. Wow. And just because I think the confidence in Bitcoin as a currency will, I think, continue to grow over time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think we're going to see, you know, the continual trend of local currencies disappearing in some countries. And but there will always be a need, I think, for, a multiple lifetimes where the U.S. dollar, the Chinese yuan, the euro, you know, those are still going to be prevalent, you know, currencies that are in use, use globally. But I do think that, you know, there's the trend of, you know, lesser used and higher risk considered local currencies in these countries is going to keep disappearing.
So maybe of that total number of, what I say, 82 trillion, if half of that is the big three, euro, like the American, it would be the smaller, the BRICS, maybe the Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa type of countries consolidating into $41 trillion of circulated money being crypto.
Yeah, and I think there will be a second tier where a fiat currency, you know, based countries, you know, the British pound, you know, the UK pound, you know, I don't think they will all go away, you know, easily and very quickly, but you know, so I think there'll be, you know, probably like the big three, a couple of, you know, very few second tier players that are holding on to their, you know, closely to their fiat currencies.
Call the US dollar the reserve currency, and it hasn't always been that way. It was the UK, it was Spain, you know, I think it was Rome at one point. It has changed hands. Do we foresee Bitcoin becoming the world's reserve currency, or do you think America has nothing to fear from that?
I think the U.S. probably has a little bit to fear, not just from Bitcoin. I mean, I think there was an announcement earlier today where Russia will settle a lot of its trade now, you know, specifically like oil, in the Chinese yuan. And so
that puts the petrodollar at risk as well.
Yeah, it does. And so I think, you know, I think there'll be an evolution, but it's going to take a while. But there will be an eventual evolution, I think, to the Bitcoin. But, you know, I think first there will be this competition, you know, at the higher end between, you know, particularly between the U.S. and China, and then there'll be a lot of other trade that'll take place over time that'll be based in Bitcoin. But again, it's a way for countries to almost pool their fiat currencies into something that they can all use and agree to use, which will be less susceptible to devaluation because of the printing of money and you know, speculation and because of the, you know, small usage of some of these currencies that are in use today.
The way Zimbabwe did it when they just added zeros, or Argentina. So back to the mechanics. Seems to me there are two meanings of wallet. There's browser-based and online managed services, or it can refer to a file which stores Bitcoin addresses and the private keys needed to use them. Those are the two. What is a wallet?
Well, it's in some respects similar to, the wallet that you carry with you, especially men, but really the primary purpose of a wallet is to control the security around the digital asset. And that security, and by the way, the technology and everything behind it is the same, not only for cryptocurrencies, but also for non-fungible tokens.
And I was going to get into that soon too.
So in the case of user-controlled wallet, the actual file, which represents your ownership in Bitcoin, is managed by you yourself, and the keys that unlock that cryptocurrency or that file, so you can then use it for money or sell it, is controlled by you, by the individual, he or her, herself. But in the case of a browser controlled wallet, the reality is that you're not really in possession of your money, just like your relationship that you have with your bank. If you're leaving your money at a bank, they've got your money and they control the security around your money. So in the case of people that acquire, for example, the rights, ownership rights to Bitcoin on an exchange, and they leave that Bitcoin with the exchange, and the exchange is providing the user with their wallet. The reality is that the exchange has got your money, in this case, Bitcoin, and they're the ones that are managing the security around your control of that digital asset. So it's not impossible for that money to actually be stolen from you, or your cryptocurrency being stolen from you, just like it's not impossible for someone to rob your bank and take the physical cash that was at your local community bank or savings loan or even a larger bank. So in one instance, the individual actually has the money in their physical possession, even though it's digital. And in the other example, where it's centrally managed and an exchange, for example, is controlling your wallet, you really don't have possession of that, which was really highlighted when FTX declared for bankruptcy. And so you had all these users that had, many billions of dollars in combined cryptocurrency, which was, actually being saved and managed by the exchange. These people couldn't get access to their money because they didn't really have control over it.
Yeah. And then the FTX and the bankruptcy, I guess it is an exchange, FTX, and they made transfers of about $2.2 billion to the company's founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, through related entities. How'd that fraud disrupt the market?
Well, I mean, FTX, just because of the size of FTX at the time and the publicity that they had received through, all of the, marketing that they did, including, marketing using the power of television. And, they did a great job of surrounding themselves with high profile, you know, individuals as well. You know, Tom Brady is a good example, you know, that were out there taking the lead, you know, in terms of promoting them and encouraging people to use the exchange. You know, that's the one that when it failed caught everybody's you know, attention, just because, you know, they're, you know, the arena, you know, the, you know, in Miami, they had their name on it. You know, they were a big buyer of advertising time, you know, during the Super Bowl. I mean, there's just they just had such a high profile that when the exchange collapsed, you know, and they declared for bankruptcy, you know, that was the watershed event that really caught, you know, everybody's attention. But there were other failures that kind of occurred right before that. Celsius, Voyager Capital were, I think, two that occurred right before FTX. And if people were paying attention, you could kind of see that, you know, that market was getting a little shaky. And, you know, the other thing, Steve, I think, you know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, when they mention that, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried was worth, you know, billions of dollars, the reality is that a lot of that wealth was dependent on the perceived value of several cryptocurrencies that FTX themselves created and, you know, minted basically and got out there in the market. You know, you can create 2 billion cryptocurrencies and brand them, and when they're worth when they're worth 10 times as much, that isn't necessarily, you know, people like to think that, you know, the underlying asset now is $20 billion. Well, that's not really true, because right. In the case of many of the cryptos, for example, that were minted by, you know, FTX and others, they never had that many in circulation to begin with. And so the whole idea that these exchanges were worth, you know, as much as people thought, or even the individuals involved were worth as much as they were, you know, it's kind of a fallacy, because, you know, in the case of the U.S. dollar, when we, you know, mint new, you know, currency in the U.S., that goes into circulation. You know, we don't have, you know, 90% of the U.S. dollar that was ever, you know, printed, you know, sitting in a big bank vault someplace.
Yeah. So FTX got profitable in its early days, playing the vig between Europe and Asia and America. You know, prices say a dollar in Europe today to buy and sell for $1.25 hours later in Asia and play that spread. Then that dried up when everyone else figured out that's how you could do it. And so the spread narrowed very much, and they had to get into something else, which got them into trouble because they had a gargantuan $7 billion hole in its balance sheet when it collapsed last year. And the recent court documents show that, I call them SBF, and five others from FTX and Alameda Research executives received $3.2 billion in payments and loans from FTX-linked entities. SBF reportedly received the lion's share of the funds, receiving $2.2 billion. Are they going to get away with this?
I don't think they're going to get away with it. I think the only question mark is really is the penalty going to be fairly distributed or doled out relative to the crime?
Yeah, well, all those billions were somebody else's money, right?
Right. So theory. you know. There already is, you know, examples where, you know, a lot of white collar crime, oftentimes the penalty doesn't appear to be fair when you look at, you know, the crime of, you know, a more common criminal who may, you know, stand up a 7-Eleven someplace.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, I think everybody, you know, Crime definitely doesn't pay. Eventually, if you're doing something wrong, it's going to catch up to you. So the only question really is, is the punishment that gets, eventually doled out, does that really equal the amount of harm and damage that these individuals have done to the economy and to other financial institutions? I mean, a lot of people place their bet, their faith in FTX, and as long as FTX was doing well, was healthy, they assumed then that the overall market in cryptocurrencies was probably healthy as well. Well,
certainly doesn't bring confidence to the
community. Yeah. So
tell me, what is blockchain? We hear that word a lot, but I don't understand it. What is it, and what is the value of blockchain?
Well, I'm probably not a good CTO, CIO type to explain what, best way I can describe it is it's a decentralized general ledger platform. And so, like, there are many servers that, make up, running these blockchains that are decentralized and located all over countries and all over the world. When any transaction occurs, that the blockchain itself is being used to provide a solution for or manage each of the nodes, basically, that make up the blockchain, all get updated with the information around what is happening simultaneously. So it's there are a lot of use cases and things that blockchain technology can be used for, but the big thing it provides is crazy level of trust that, that my, cryptocurrency that I, for, Bitcoin, that I actually own it, and control it. And until I sell it, it's owned by me. There's just a running, general ledger that is created that keeps getting updated over time around anything that ever occurs around that digital asset. By the way, the digital asset could be a digital form of a painting. It could be anything. And so, but it's a form of record keeping and method for providing security that ensures that there is trust in whatever it is you're doing. And that, it's...
So a chain of custody, basically, yes, a way of... Okay.
Exactly.
So exchanges, I get stocks and bond trading on exchanges and providing price discovery, but how do these crypto exchanges do it?
Well, you mentioned earlier, I kind of started my career in New York and spent a number of years working down Wall Street, and I was involved in selling trading system platform technology. And back in the day, we had these market makers, like you kind of like alluded to this before, that would create a market in various securities. So they would make a market, maybe an IBM stock, and let's say IBM stock was trading at $90, they would fulfill a buy order of IBM at $90, but they themselves then were in control of that asset. And then they would look to find a buyer at 92, 93, 94, whatever the number is, and then profit the spread. And everybody was okay with that because they were providing a market in those securities. They were taking possession of the securities and taking on the risk associated with that, because there's always the chance that IBM stock could have gone down during that period of time. But what was different about that, and what doesn't occur in the case of a crypto exchange, is that the public had no idea who sold that security for $90, or that it even was sold at $90 and then got, turned around and sold for a profit. But in the case of a crypto or it could be an NFT, there's a public record then of everything that takes place involving any transaction around that particular Bitcoin or NFT, whatever it is that's using blockchain technology. So, it just creates more visibility and more transparency and trust.
So that avoids me taking it from you for $10, turning around and giving it to somebody else for $20, some excessive type of ripoff. This is more price discovery. So Binance, I think is how you call it, the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, they just were exposed for secretly moved $400 million from its U.S. partner to a company managed by the crypto giant boss Zhao called Merit Peak. I don't know if you know about this, but it still certainly doesn't instill confidence either. But it also brings in the SEC. So the whole idea of avoiding like the U.S. government scrutiny with a crypto or a secret currency isn't even working. Does that make sense? Like,
well, it kind of became pretty obvious to me early on that there had to be more regulation. And quite honestly, it's not, there's a ton of regulation when it comes to, securities and fixed income instruments, because, the role of the government is to create, trust in the system and ensure that the public gets protected and doesn't get ripped off. But one of the things so with the cryptocurrency market, there was no oversight that really was taking place. And, it kind of became clear pretty early on that there was, it basically created an environment where there could be a lot of fraud that could take place because there wasn't this regulation and oversight that was taking place. For example, you mentioned, we talked about, market makers and securities or fixed income instruments. But, one of the other things that FTX was doing, for example, is they were serving as a market maker themselves. They could put their thumb on the scale in terms of the price and begin to manipulate, the price of their the FTX created cryptocurrencies that they had, in circulation in the market. So, it's just, you just can't have that, because it, we've seen, too many times, whether it's energy or stocks or anything, if there's not oversight and protections being provided by the government, that, there's always going to be crooks in the world. And
yeah,
always,
that just makes it so much easier with that. I've seen a lot of wallets getting hacked in headlines too, and money disappearing. Is cybersecurity still an issue with crypto, or have they fixed all that?
That is an area, pretty familiar with cybersecurity space and the technology and everything, but that's an area like I don't really, Steve, kind of understand very well myself. I think some of it is caused by people in trust, putting their trust in the exchanges to handle cybersecurity for them. And once you centralize the management of, for example, keys, you're basically communicating to the market where the bad guys need to go to rob you, because everything's centralized. It's controlled by
at least in the traditional banks. They have a vault, they have a big door, they've got
in the old days, the money was all in the bank vault, even if it was a small town or something. At least now, JP Morgan doesn't keep a whole lot of cash in local bank vaults anywhere. But when you're an exchange, you're basically telling the bad guys where they need to go to hack you. And then there are examples where users had locally managed wallets where they've gotten hacked. Well, that's really due to the fact that they didn't take the necessary precautions around their maintaining their own security of their wallet, and so they
using password as their password or something like that.
Using their daughter's name as the password or something,
but making it easy for the professionals. So the origin story in comic book terms for crypto was a super secret underground money that the governments and Big Brother couldn't keep track of. Seems to me it's grown into the opposite. Cash and gold are the private transaction mediums, and every crypto transaction is monitorable, like you talked about, the blockchain. Do I have that wrong?
No, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, I just don't, like people talk about CBDCs, I don't understand the value today of a CBDC, because really the blockchain technology is providing, and distributed general ledger technology is providing full transparency around any transactions, anything involving the movement of that money. And the other thing is, the banks already have the records and financial institutions for, where money is being sent to and where it's being received from. The only question is, did somebody do a good enough job when the accounts are being opened to verify that, the users and businesses are who they say they are. And so if adequate, know your customer and anti-money laundering technology and stuff's in place, it really shouldn't be an issue.
So Bernard Arnault is the richest man in the world. With a business empire that spans over 70 brands, including, hopefully you can see that, Scott, 70 brands, including Sephora and Louis Vuitton, and has featured among the world's richest since 1985. It's been around a while. Christian Dior. His report show that the billionaire teamed up with Microsoft Azure and Consensus last year to develop a blockchain platform that will track products produced by LVMH. So we've seen that some of the credit card companies like Discover were willing to hand over to the FBI folks who had purchased something from, let's say, a gun store. You know, when he gets into political hands, looking and seeing where those transactions are, not just ladies' handbags or whatever, then we got a kind of a problem, because you're not being able to deal freely with whatever you want to in a community like ours, a country like ours, where we are capitalists and we like to do transactions, private transactions. If we get rid of cash for electric money, nothing will be private, right? And all the biggest billionaires are into crypto now. Buffett, Gates, Larry Ellison, Jeff Bezos, and PayPal and Amazon are dealing in Bitcoin. Maybe Amazon's on the fence on that, but they're about to, I think. And they may be forced to if that's the way money transacts. Will we see more things like insurance and taxes take Bitcoin, or the opposite? Will it fade away and just be an alternative, like you choose between a $100 bill or a nickel?
I think we're going to see more and more businesses willing to accept Bitcoin and probably Ether as a replacement currency for the US dollar.
Wow. And it's so volatile, the price swings thousands of dollars when you sell to pay bills or taxes. That's a capital gain, and likely short-term capital gain, which is taxed at the highest rate. I'm not a CPA, but it seems like an expensive way to stay liquid.
Yep, that's correct. But, you only have to look back to 2012, where Bitcoin was worth zero. Even at its lowest point, I think, which was probably November of last year, it got down to about 17,000 per Bitcoin. It's already back up to a little over 27,000 today. Ether is back up to over 1,700, and I think that's due to the volatility in the U.S. dollar and due to inflation and other things. I mean, it's the U.S. dollar hasn't proven to be a really good hedge against currency, against inflation and through the devaluation from deficit spending that's been going on in the country. So you can make an argument it's less risky and has the propensity to do, you know, much better in terms of retaining its value and even increasing in value over time.
Okay. I got about 5 more minutes with you, so I want to jam through these if I can. A bill was just introduced in Tennessee to allow the state and municipalities to invest in Bitcoin. Another bill introduced the same day seeks to establish a working group to study how Tennessee could become the nation's top destination for Bitcoin businesses. Okay. Tennessee House Bill 2644, you're probably familiar with it because you have a company here. Quote, as introduced, authorizes the county, municipality, or the state to invest in cryptocurrency, blockchains, and non-fungible tokens, according to the bill's summary. Lawmakers have been actively submitting Bitcoin-related proposals all over the country. Is this the beginning of the central bank-issued digital currency, and what's a non-fungible token?
Well, really a CBDC is not unlike a centrally managed cryptocurrency. And by the way, I'm of the belief that many of those are going to disappear here pretty quick. And only the decentralized protocols will make it. What a CBDC, especially if it's a version of the U.S. dollar, doesn't curtail the government's ability to print money and deficit spend and pursue monetary policies and political policies that devalue the currency. So it could be called a CBDC, but at the end of the day, it's still a representation of the U.S. dollar that is not unlike the digital representation of the dollar that's in your bank account. You know, the U.S. dollar has been digitized for a long time.
Sure.
And in fact, COVID, there was this belief that physical currency was going to go, you know, out of circulation over time and everything would be digital. Well, we're almost there now. You know, we probably saw 7 years worth of adoption of mobile payment technology that took place in 2 years due to COVID. There was just cash use almost disappeared overnight, and everything is digital now.
JP Morgan's analyst said the Fed's new bank backstop program could inject up to $2 trillion into the financial system. Yeah. So technology investor and former Coinbase chief tech officer Balaji Srinivasan, sorry, I don't know how to say that, was warned the latest banking crisis could spark hyperinflation in the U.S. and advise people to buy Bitcoin now and get your coins off exchanges. Well, I wish I had a whole bunch of more time to ask questions from you, but we are at the end here. So please tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you, StaxPay, and follow your social media.
Yeah, well, the website address is the best place to go. It's actually, the URL is www.staxsports, and it's STAKS sports, .com. That's the best place to go to find out more about the company. And you know, there's a lot of ways to contact me if you want to reach out to me directly. Feel free to do so. And Steve, I hope you didn't get me in trouble with any government authorities on this call. So thank you for inviting.
Well, we're lovers of truth, and you told it like it is. I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on with us.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your week and have a great weekend. All right.
You too. Yep.
I'm Dan McCaleb, executive editor of the Center Square Newswire Service. You're listening to us on the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what do you think of our guest Scott Prager and his crypto knowledge?
Well, I thank you for bringing him on. I've often wondered what this is all about, and I've I want to say, here's the guy that we just talked about, the FTX guy.
And marketing, yeah.
Yeah, and Forbes just did this wonderful thing about him, article and everything. This is back in 2021, of course. What's interesting, Steve, is it's a Bernie Madoff situation. Same kind of thing. You build it up, you flesh it out, everybody invests in it, and the next thing you know, you find out that it's just all a Ponzi scheme. I believe that's the same thing with FTX. I hope these guys go to jail. And yeah. I don't find any more security in a digital currency than I do in anything else. And personally, I'm not into it. It's not my thing. So, but if somebody wants to, it's their own money.
Like Will Rogers said, it's the return of my money, not the return on my money I'm concerned about. So let's start with my favorite Sunday talk show host, a little blast from the past. Here is Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. I liked Tim Russert so much more, but anyway, here he is.
Please get vaccinated. If you know someone who's not vaccinated, find a way to convince them to get vaccinated. Literally, the only people dying are the unvaccinated. And for those of you spreading misinformation, shame on you. Shame on you. Mm. People are needlessly dying because of your misinformation. Think about it. I don't know how some of you sleep at night who are doing this for a living.
I gotta cry, Steve. I gotta cry.
For those of you on Rumble, that was 2021. Psychotic flashback from MSNBC, finger wagging and all. Chuck Todd taking the high road. MSNBC made good money in 2021, much of it from Pfizer. Ad spending for Pfizer was $3.8 billion in 2010, $3.6 billion in 2011, $2.8 billion in 2012, $3 billion in 2013, $3.1 billion in 2014, $3.1 billion in 2015, $3.2 billion in 2016, $3.1 billion in 2017, $2.7 billion in 2018, $2.3 billion in 2019, $1.8 billion in 2020. Large decrease before pandemic. $2 billion in 2021, $2.8 billion in 2022. So the average, $2.76 billion per year over the last 12 years. That'll get Chuck Todd's finger wagging. Let's hear from Shannon Joy and her recent interview with a truthful doctor, likely not paid, shill, by Pfizer or Moderna, actually a whistleblower, Pfizer program director Amy Kelly.
So I did a report back over the summer about male reproductive function being affected by the vaccines and what had been reported and what was available so far. And I'm going to actually have to look at my notes some here because of some of the terminology.
Okay, that's all right.
But So one thing we found was that in 2018, the medical community was already aware that liponanid particles had negative effects on reproductive organs. There was a paper published on it. What? It's still up today. And so that was a known quantity going into a situation where that was being used as part of these mRNA vaccines. And Pfizer, in their own documentation, did studies, which we may have spoken about before, but I'll recap here, called biodistribution studies.
Yep.
And what that means is how the ingredients in the vaccine travel through the body. So to recap, they knew during the clinical trials that when they injected it into somebody's arm, it didn't stay in the arm, it traveled all over the body. And in their biodistribution studies, one of the things they show is how the ingredients are collecting in the testes. That was one of the many organs that was listed out. So they admitted it. They admitted that it crosses the blood testes barrier.
Oh, wow.
That's what $2.7 billion of advertising will not tell you. Pfizer's biodistribution studies. Their studies showed contents of the C-19 shot collected in male genitalia, Pfizer's documents analysis program director Amy Kelly. One of the things they show is how the ingredients are collected in the testes. That was one of the many organs that were listed out. So they admitted it. They admitted that it crosses the blood testes barrier. Don't you think they were advertising that on network television as a vaccine feature? But gross profit for Pfizer was, in 2020, $33.16 billion, up 1% from 2019. 2021, $50.46 billion, up 52.16% from 2020. 2022, $65.98 billion, up 30.75% from 2021. Gross profit for the 12-month ending December 31st, 2022 was $65.98 billion, a 30.75% increase year over year. That's with that advertising bot. Here's another doctor I've learned to trust, Dr. Peter McCullough. We've played sound from him before. He's been in my newspaper many times, but this is good. Listen.
But let's name some names when we say they. I think it's fair to say this. So let me throw out a name and you tell me if they're in or out. How about Klaus Schwab?
Nobody will be safe if not everybody is vaccinated.
Klaus Schwab in.
Bill Gates.
Normalcy only returns when we've largely vaccinated the entire global population.
The fatality rate, you know, we didn't understand that it's a fairly low fatality rate and that it's a disease mainly of the elderly, kind of like flu is, although a bit different than that.
In.
Jacinda Ardern, Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Frankly, conspiracy theories.
In.
Justin Trudeau, Canada.
Let people fall prey to disinformation. And if conservative MPs and others want to start talking about conspiracy theories, well, that's their choice.
In.
President Biden.
Let me say that again. It's a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
In.
Ashish Jha.
I don't know that name.
He's the current White House coronavirus coordinator.
Don't wait. Get your COVID shot. Get your flu shot. That's why God gave you two arms. You can one in each arm if you want.
In.
Anthony Fauci.
So maybe it doesn't work, and they're simply not telling you that.
That's just a typical crazy conspiracy theory.
In.
Robert Califf, head of the FDA.
Right now, the U.S. is a place where there's a lot of work to do to figure out what's happened recently. So tech savvy. And yet life expectancy going backwards.
In.
How about Peter Marks, FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee?
There is a lot of misinformation about the new COVID-19 bivalent vaccines, and this misinformation is dangerous to public health. We know some parents are having a hard time deciding whether to vaccinate their children against COVID-19. But there are considerable risks to not getting your child vaccinated.
In.
How about Dr. Rubin, editor of New England Journal of Medicine?
They seem very safe. They seem very comparable to other vaccines.
That's advertising money can't buy, right?
Oh,
isn't Pfizer great, Steve? Don't you want to go out and buy all the products now?
You know, to think that I owned shares of them one time, I was totally ignorant before all this took place, Steve. I think all your listeners are probably like me. We just thought, oh, it's just a company, and didn't think anything about the fact that these guys have been doing this for a very long time.
No. And with the rise in aggressive cancers popping up everywhere, what did they do with those ill-gotten profits? Pfizer is spending $43 billion to reach deeper into new cancer treatments that target tumor cells while sparing surrounding healthy tissue, buying Seagen, S-E-A-G-E-N, to access cancer drugs. The arsonist funding the fire department on profits from selling a product that doesn't work. Okay, next. A new study at the University of Colorado in Boulder indicates that pharmaceutical companies have partnered with so-called patient influencers to promote prescription medications on social media. In the study published this week in the Journal of Medicine, in the Journal of Medical Internet Research, lead author Aaron Willis, an associate professor of advertising, public relations, and media design at CU, interviewed 26 such patient influencers. All participants have struggled with a chronic medical condition, including lupus, Parkinson's disease, asthma, HIV, celiac disease, chronic migraines, and perimenopause, and all have used social media platforms regularly to discuss health and collaborate with brands. According to the study, some of the influencers, though it's unclear how many, had also been paid to promote various medications. And though influencers who have been sponsored by pharmaceutical companies must designate their promotional posts as ads, most of the influencers have a relatively limited following usually between 1,000 and 40,000 followers, which can make tracking compliance difficult. Let's hear from clip number four.
Somebody that questioned everything, and it really started when I was a teenager, asked, why do we have to take the tetanus vaccine every 10 years? And just to shorten this for a time's sake, is that I ended up finding out, asking all of my attending physicians, infectious disease experts, we found out that, you know, the reason that they told us back then to take it was that when you are walking out in the yard, you have a rusty nail in your foot, the bacteria called tetanus gets in there. And then within minutes to hours, not days or weeks, you could spasm so terribly that you would suffocate to death and fall on the floor and die, like within minutes to hours, which I'd never heard of anyone dying that way. So come to find out that is a lie. No one has died that way. Nobody in the entire world in the history of our written history, right?
Yeah.
I heard
so why are they giving it out if that's a lie, right? So I was doing an observation on my rotations in Detroit, Michigan, when I was training, and I saw that they gave some people the vaccine for tetanus and some not as a protocol. And the ones that were on welfare did not get it, but the ones who private pay did, which didn't make sense. But I saw there's a huge difference in fertility, huge. The people who didn't get it were extremely fertile. The people who did had a lot of problems. I Googled it then, and sure enough, you can still find this if you Google it, that the World Health Organization and NIH have since 1972 been developing the tetanus vaccine as an abortion or sterilization vaccine. They've been putting the pregnancy hormone inside the tetanus vaccine in that vial. And so every time you get it, it's a cumulative response. Your body will then see, if you're female, you'll see when you're getting pregnant, you have a higher and higher HCG level, right?
Yep.
Well, then your body will then learn to attack that. So it's going to attack an early pregnancy. So then-
That's Dr. Matt. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
That was Dr. Madej, I'm not sure how to say it, M-A-D-E-J. So again, proving that our episode on the book Turtles All the Way Down is starting to be common knowledge now. The study also, back to the article, the study also suggested that paying patient influencers might be an inevitable consequence of direct-to-consumer advertising, which costs pharmaceutical companies $6.58 billion. In 2020, even though DTC advertising is legal only in the US and New Zealand. About half of all consumers who request a medication after seeing an advertisement for it ultimately receive a prescription for it from their doctor. Let's talk money for a second. Let's hear clip number five.
To Credit Suisse, they've had a series of scandals and compliance issues and exec changes over the past few years, but there is a common pattern here with what's happening in the U.S. banking system, which is these banks are under tremendous stress right now. And if there's weaknesses at these banks, they're getting flushed out and exposed, and deposits are leaving the system very quickly, causing these banks to be imperiled, and then potentially creating the risk of the next cascading failure, because all these banks are sort of interlinked, and this is where you get sort of systemic risk. So what is causing this stress? I would posit that the reason for the stress is that we've had this rate tightening cycle for the last year. It's the fastest time that interest rates have been hiked by the Fed in our entire lifetimes. And what caused that? It was the worst inflation in 40 years. So this is basically what is putting tremendous stress on the whole banking system, is that rates have gone up so violently and so suddenly that deposits are leaving because they're going to other alternatives like money market funds, but also assets on the books that were supposed to be safe, like long-dated bonds, T-bills, mortgage bonds, all of a sudden they've become toxic assets. They were supposed to be safe assets. Now they're basically toxic. And I think that everybody's trying to understand how deep this problem goes. And it's good in a sense that, you know, whether it's the Swiss government or the Fed is kind of taking steps to intervene and prevent a total run on the banks. I think that's good. But the problem is we've had such bad Fed policy for the last number of years now that it's entirely too little too late. And that's what makes the situation.
I just wanted to throw that in there, but I'm going to change the subject real quick. I'm picking on OSU this week. They deserve it. Scholars seeking a job in Ohio State University's College of Engineering, not social economics, but engineering, must pledge their allegiance to diversity, equity, and inclusion as part of the process. University officials ask applicants to provide a statement that describes their commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion, along with specific examples such as teaching and or mentoring students from underrepresented backgrounds, outreach activities to underrepresented groups, or conducting research and address social inequities. According to a copy of the application rubric recently tweeted by John Saylor with the National Association of Scholars, boom, another national association of something or other to put on the list to keep an eye on. A popular movement that has been around decades before it became a TikTok trend, that a woman showing their meticulously organized and styled pantries and cabinets has been branded as allegedly built upon a history of classist, racist, and sexist social structures, according to Loyola University professor. Loyola professor declares white women's pantries racist, claims cleanliness upholds racism. Associate professor of marketing, associate professor, keep that in mind too.
Steve, did you say panties or pantries?
Pantries. Okay, I'm not going down there. No, up there. Dr. Jenna Drenton took note of the recent online trend of so-called pantry porn. It's always an associate professor. Ever notice that? Not full professor, associate. That's interesting. Either the boss is passing it off to his underlings or the newbies are plum loco. Oh boy. PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, now says cow's milk has been a symbol used by white supremacists. Check it out on PETA.org. I don't make this stuff up. What does drinking milk have to do with white supremacy? Is the title. What does it have to do with ethical treatment of animals? Is my question. Not to be outdone, another hack organization, an article published by AFRU, A-F-R-U magazine, raised questions about coffee's racist history and how it upholds systems of white supremacy. There are two main arguments put forth in this case. The history of coffee is undeniably linked to colonialism and is increasingly gentrified and exploited by predominantly white organizations. Starbucks, Dunkin', and Tim Hortons are the three largest coffee companies in the world. Some of the other leading brands include Lavazza, Costa Coffee, and McDonald's McCafe. Of all these six companies, only one has a non-white CEO, Starbucks. But your coffee, buy your coffee accordingly. Oh, Steve, did you see the UK's Daily Mail says Jesus would get vaccine?
I heard many a pastor and many a denominational leader and religious leader say the same beep thing. I think it's the most blasphemous. If you can get
Archbishop of Canterbury suggests as he was getting the jab is not about me and my rights to choose. It's about how I love my neighbor. What do you think of that statement?
Again, that's what you call taking God's name in vain.
Would God double mask and get his fifth booster shot?
No, he built our immune system, Steve, and with 0.008% of people dying and everybody else living from a bug, I don't think we needed any of what we just went through for the last 3 years.
Yeah. The fiscal burden of illegal immigration on United States taxpayers, 2023, by the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR, concludes that American taxpayers pay overall around $182 billion annually for services and benefits to illegal immigrants. However, those costs are offset by around $31 billion in taxes collected from what they estimate is 15.5 million illegal immigrants in the United States. Those costs represent a 30% increase since 2017. That's a lot of loving thy neighbor already. I feel bad for taxpayers. Total fleecing. Okay. Oh, and we'll follow up. New emails reveal the Electronic Registration Information Center, ERIC, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, pretty clever, that's ERIC again, aka Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Meta, Richie Rich, facilitated the secure transfer of ERIC member data to this private third-party organization run by ERIC founder and ex-board member David Becker. Becker founded both ERIC and CEIR with George Soros. How do you feel about the chain of custody of your vote in Soros's hands?
I don't feel well at all.
Me either. More on that to come, I'm sure. Stay tuned for my quotes of the day. Welcome to my quotes for the day. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify or iTunes and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thanks for doing it. Paper money is going away. Elon Musk, according to Forbes Number two, richest man, $185 billion, a lot to lose. Because you know resilience, if you think of it in terms of the gold rush, then you'd be pretty depressed right now because the last nugget of gold would be gone. But the good thing is, with innovation, there isn't a last nugget. Every new thing creates two new questions and two new opportunities. Jeff Bezos, number three, $122 billion. Increasingly, companies outside of finance are using blockchain technology to replace long-held authentic practices in law, real estate, and shipping. Larry Ellison, number four, $109 billion. That was 2017. The future of money is digital currency. Bill Gates, boo. Number five, richest man, $107 billion. If you don't find a way to make money while you sleep, you will work until you die. Warren Buffett, last check, number six, richest man at only $101 billion. Bitcoin is remarkable cryptographic achievement, and the ability to create something that is not duplicable in the digital world has enormous value. Eric Schmidt, former Google CEO, only 17 billion today. Still a lot at stake. Bitcoin has the balance and incentives right, and that is why it is starting to take off. Julian Assange, WikiLeaks founder, stuck in a UK prison. Bitcoin won't last, but crypto is here to stay. Edward Snowden, former CIA employee trapped in Russia. That's it for this episode. Really hope you like it. Thank you, Scott Pranger, for watching out for our money until they turn it into bits and bytes, ones and zeros, mostly zeros. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of mcview.us. Peace in our time.
Children and the pumpkins at the county fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row of cotton and corn, moving through this place just like rolling thunder. Lord, I love the land where I was born.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.